so much more information, and I think it's really, really powerful. What I want to do now is ask some questions. If people have any questions, it should be a question, not a comment. I would love to see people talk about comments, but we can go on and on. But please, ahead, question.
Sure. I'm Subramanian Vasudevan. I go by Vasu. Thank you very much for this wonderful book. I will make a short comment if you don't mind. Maybe 20 years ago, I tried to clarify what Varna and Jati were on Wikipedia. And it was seconds before it was taken down, and changing those, you know, entrenched perceptions turned out ultimately to be impossible. I hope your book has a different outcome. Just one question I have is, in terms of caste, Jati, Varna, whatever, do you think we should have an affirmative defense, which is to say this is something that is needed given the diversity of India and it's worked for India? Or should we say that India has passed it and it doesn't really matter to us anymore, so don't use that as a point of criticism?
So I would say we should keep here the debate to the United States. We are on more solid grounds. There is no empirical evidence of Indian employers discriminating on caste grounds. I don't know of any such thing. Whether it's Cisco or Google or Microsoft, where there are thousands of people, Indians, I don't think that you can say that they are caste discriminating. If you stick to this, then you can say they're all Hindus, practicing Hindus, but we don't see the problem. So how can you couple it as a Hindu problem? I think that's the way to argue.
Hi, sir. My name is Ankit Shukla. So my question is, like you have very correctly said, we are not born out of any particular caste. We don't associate with the caste as we were born many years ago, like 200, 300 years ago, you would be called Brahmin or Shudra or something. Whatever you do is your caste. So now in the current context also, does it make sense to start associating ourselves with our job? Let's say if somebody asks, so for Hindus, let's say we should educate people and tell them, like, I am an engineer and also I teach yoga and meditation and things like that. So in one part of me is one caste, which is an engineer, and that could be called one kind of caste. And the other thing which I am doing on that is yoga and others could be called something else. So we ourselves could portray ourselves and tell it to people to educate them in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. In fact, I say that to people that now we are doing many varnas at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, when I debate, when I write books, I'm a Brahmin. When I go and fight some people, you know, in some activist session, the scholar is a Brahmin, the activist is a Kshatriya.
Correct.
That's the difference between scholar and activist. When I'm making money, right now I'm not making money, but I'm investing at least so I can pay my bills. In that capacity, or when I'm doing, you know, funding work and all that, then I'm a Vaishya, right?
Yeah.
When I'm vacuuming the place or taking my car for a wash or doing the laundry, I'm a Shudra. So I'm doing everything the same day.
Correct.
So that's how life is today.
So I think that's what I'm saying. So we should publicize this thing and make it very common for everyone to understand. And maybe this book would serve as a basis, and everyone should use
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Myself, Venkat Nag. I'm author of, I'm a historian and writer too. So I'm author of this book, Lokamanya Tilak's Historic Speeches. So as of today's topic, so more than a question, this is a detail followed by a question. So as a point that you made earlier about Shudra Varna being more in Indian schools, pre-independent era. So of course, fortunately I come from this district, Ballari, where this education survey was first carried out. And then I have this data, so in which in my hometown, there were like about 503 schools, pre-independent era. We had 3,000 about Shudra Varna people in the schools, and then about 1,000 who belonged to Brahmin Varna. So this is the data that I have from the original survey that was carried out. We have all these evidences, we have all this data. But my question is, how do we put this whole evidence and data into a legal framework here to fight bills like SB403 and things like that. So this is all the evidence that can have a very valid point in the legal framework of the system.
This
so,
data is from India.
So this data, yeah, from the survey that was originally carried out by...
So, but I don't think that would be relevant in this country.
Because but that's still a data that shows us how non-discriminative we were. So, that's
so that should be published. You should put it out in a newspaper, or you should put an article. Write an article and put it out in some place. Publish it so other people can reference it.
Namaste Rajivji. Thank you for always. It's always enlightening. My name is Sandeep Somani. So limiting our scope to US and Western world, I'm really surprised that caste here has gone so far with SB403, Cisco case, all of that. Because how do you define someone's caste over here? So that is a very, I thought that should disqualify any case, anything. Like an American Hindu, what's his caste?
Right.
White Hindu, what's his caste?
Right.
This doesn't make sense. And I'm so.
Also, you know, that? Also yeah. The Hindus who came from the Caribbean.
Yes.
They have no idea of caste.
Right. So, still it has some here.
Which shows the power of politics.
Yeah.
Activism. All this wokeism. How powerful it is.
Namaste Rajivji. It's good to hear you. Just, I was sitting in a meeting organized by the AJC in the interfaith thing during the Thanksgiving period, and I was sitting, we were in group. I was sitting next to a Jew, and I was trying to explain to him about the qualities that we Hindus have as full of fraternity and friendship and oneness. And then he, after listening to all this, he just turned around and said, well, you have all these caste systems, and we too many castes and this and that. How would you respond to an abrupt question like that?
So you have to do it through experience, like I did. I mean, the more experience you get encountering people outside your community, because we are sitting, Hindus are sitting and talking to only Hindus. That's the problem. One of the things I did 30 years ago is get out of the shell and engage other people. Then you learn through experience how to combat. You only learn Kshatriyata in the Kurukshetra. You learn in the battlefield. So you have to, I'm glad you face this, because it makes you understand, wait, you know, what is this going on? So you have to learn how to respond.
I did tell him, I said, I'm a Hindu and I really have no caste. I want to tell you. And I said, discrimination of caste, even in India, is illegal according to the Prevention of Atrocities Act passed by the Parliament in 1983. And I sort of calmed him down. He was not convinced. But I have his name and number. I'm going to send him this book.
Yeah, yeah. And you should tell him, listen, I can give you 100 different things people say about Jews. But you will tell me that we should learn about Jews from Jews, not from hearsay. So same way, you should learn about Hinduism from our authorities, our experts. And I'll give you a book. Rather than from hearsay, what this guy said, what that guy said. That's all nonsense. You should talk back like that.
I did tell him that amongst the Jews, Kohens are the best or better than the most, and the Ashrafs and the Afzals in the Islamic religion. I don't think he was convinced, but I gave him enough material. But I think we need to open up more, like you said. So, but this is the problem I faced. And it was an abrupt question that I was shocked.
You should get a whole lot of copies of this and give it to the AJC people. Just send it out, bulk. Say, read it. And if they invite me to give a seminar, I'll come there. If you organize it.
Hello, Rajivji. Hello, Rajivji. I have a question. What is your opinion about Manu Smriti?
Okay. So, Manu Smriti is one of the Dharma Shastras, one of many Dharma Shastras. It is not a legal document in the sense that a Kshatriya, a king, said, this is my constitution and this is the law I will enforce. It's not. So it's not of legal authority. It is a scholar. Manu was a great scholar. And Manu says himself,
This is descriptive and not prescriptive, meaning I'm describing how the jatis behave. And what ought to be done depends on the context, depends on the region. Maybe something which is good in one region is bad in the other region, because it's not like there's one uniform law that everybody has to follow. Manusmriti himself says that. Manu himself says also that what I'm proposing here should change with times. So these are very important points. That Manusmriti is not like some Quran which says it's final, nobody can change it, nobody can question it, and this will happen, that will happen, nothing like that. It's a very open document. That's one point. Second point, there are horrible things proposed in it, which were there is no evidence of even once being enforced. Like it says that if some guy who's not qualified to be hearing the Vedas and all that, he hears the Vedas, they should put lead in his ear. But there is not one instance ever recorded that anybody ever had lead put in his ear. So it is somebody writing this, but it's never implemented. On the other hand, it has some very amazing, very liberal social ideas about women, about freedom. It actually has a huge amount of original fellow. So he's not like that. He's holding out on his own. Whether he'll do well or not, I don't know. We'll see. But that's a different matter. Your question is how to handle his Hindu identity.
Namaste, Rajivji. Rajivji, main prashn nahi puch rahi hun. Aapko sabse pehle badhai ye pustak likhne ke liye. Bahut hi kaam ki pustak likhi aapne. और यहाँ पे जो बच्चे पैदा हुए हैं उनको ये भी नहीं मालूम कि उनकी जाति और वर्ण क्या है जो पढ़ते हैं. हम लोग कभी ऐसे घर में ज़्यादा बात नहीं करते पेरेंट्स. तो मेरा सोचना ये कि बच्चों को हम कैसे सिखाएं. तो मैं अपनी तरफ से सोच रही हूँ कि मैं इस साल हिंदी यूएसए में जितने भी बच्चे ग्रेजुएट होने वाले हैं उन सबको आपकी पुस्तक दूंगी एज ए गिफ्ट. और मैं यही चाहती हूँ कि बाकी लोग भी इस तरह से बाल विहार या हाई स्कूल या जहाँ भी दे सकते हैं वो दें. तो धन्यवाद.
वेरी गुड. आप एक और मैं आपको खुशखबरी देता हूँ कि ये जो वर्ण जाति कास्ट की पुस्तक है इसका हिंदी में अनुवाद हो रहा है होपफुली बाय जुलाई अगस्त जब हमारा बिग इवेंट होगा तो इसकी हम हिंदी एडिशन भी लॉन्च करेंगे. Another couple of things I'll tell you, very interesting. You know, my book, The Battle for Sanskrit, you people might know, where it exposes jo Sanskrit, yahan par Americans or British, jo Western log Sanskrit ke scholars hain, who are very powerful people. And they are the ones who start this nonsense because they are the ones who interpret the Sanskrit texts. They are the ones who interpret the Vedas, the Ramayana, they call him Ram, a male chauvinist and a casteist and all these things. It starts with people who understand our text and misunderstand. So this is a book criticizing those people and 400-500 pages. It's called The Battle for Sanskrit. Means I am taking back the Sanskrit interpretation back to our heritage and fighting those who are doing the wrong thing. Now in India there is Rashtriya Sanskrit Sansthan, government body. That is the main body for promoting Sanskrit, and about 32-33 Sanskrit universities in India. They have about 1 lakh students total, lot of students. And they've all become organized into one big national Sanskrit university. So the chancellor of that wrote to me 2 years ago saying that they want to set up a team of Sanskrit scholars and translate my book into Sanskrit. And the Sanskrit edition of this Battle for Sanskrit will become a textbook that they will use whenever they are training people in the master's level. After learning the language, then they have to read the texts. So far, they could only read Vedas and old texts. But nothing new about society, nothing new about today's what is happening, what are the challenges. So if this becomes a text that every future Sanskrit scholar will study, then these scholars will go and combat and they will become our team to fight back because we will have 1 lakh students a year coming out who know about our side of the problem. So the good news is that this book is now, after 2 years, this book is ready. It is in final review and we'll have it published by middle of year. We'll have Sanskrit people learning about the battle for Sanskrit.
Jai Shri Ram, Rajiv Ji. My name is Amit. I would like to urge you to explain the students in this country or the young generation in this country more scientifically about the jati, varna, and caste or untouchability, which they would hear from different sources, which used to happen in India. For an example, I still recall 40 years back, my nani never used to allow people from different, they were jamidars, but they were, she never used to allow the people from different profession, like somebody who's doing leather work, somebody is doing cattle, raising chickens or goats. She would not allow to use the home utensils to give them the water or the food. They will be welcome, they will be given everything. But I still remember she, when I really pressed it and asked that why it is like that, she said that we don't have any defense against the diseases or bacteria or virus. She explained it in Marathi, local language. These people carry. They live on farm, they move from town to town. These people work very closely with dead animals, they go fishing. And
basically, it's a hygiene system.
It's a hygiene. That yes. time there was
it
no...
Started, it started as a hygiene system.
Correct.
It started as a hygiene system that the purest things, which are deities, murtis, you know, very pure, these are very important to us. And the dirtiest things are, you know, people who are working with the beef and with leather and, you know, those kind of bad things on corpses and whatnot. So the people who are all the time doing that and don't have that hygiene sense should not be the ones touching these holy things, these spiritual things. It started like that one.
Yeah, it started like that, but she didn't even give an angle of God or deities. She yeah. gave the angle of defending the family.
Yeah.
Because at that time, besides penicillin, there was no other antibiotic or any other medication for, you know, today's COVID has kind of emerged from people to people contact through contacts. And I think that was a great way of limiting the diseases within the towns and your smaller community. I think that angle would help kids to understand it in a better perspective. Thank you.
Namaste, Ms. Samir. I have two questions. First question is, why the Buddhism died in India? So basically Buddhism born in India and then afterwards it died. So why? So what is your thought?
Yeah, let me answer that first. Let me answer because I'll forget otherwise. So Buddhism was it was not householder. Buddhism, they would give up their family and live as monks, single monks in a monastery. So a monastery could have thousands of monks. A place like Nalanda could have tens of thousands. So very centralized. Whereas in Hinduism, the guru and the priests, whatever, all the Brahmins, all, whoever is the caretaker of the faith, they're householders, they have family. So they're not leaving the family and living in one separate place. When all the Buddhists of New Jersey living in one vihar, one big institution with the closed walls, it's very easy to surround them and finish them off. Very easy. But if you have Hindus there, if there are 1 lakh Buddhists living all in one place, it's very easy to destroy the whole of Buddhism in a few places. Whereas if you have the same 1 lakh Hindus, they're scattered in all over, everybody here, there, it's very difficult to catch hold of so many of them. So one was the decentralized social structure of the Hindus and the centralized social structure of the Buddhists, because they believe that you become a monk and this becomes your lifelong thing. And then you live with other monks. This is a very important point. Second, the Hindus who had the Kshatriyas would fight back also. Buddhists did not. So this is part of the vulnerability the Buddhists had. Buddhists more easily accepted that this thing and did not have the way to fight back. So these are some, when you look at what happened, if you look at how they destroyed Nalanda, for example, you will see this happening over and over again.
And my second question is related with the Dravid movement.
So what movement?
Dravid. Dravidian movement.
Dravidian.
Happening in South India. So how you see the, it is anti-caste or it is pro-caste?
So the Dravidian movement is started by this guy, Bishop Caldwell. This Max Müller started the Aryan and Bishop Caldwell started the Dravidian. And in one of the most prestigious places in Chennai, the big round circle, they have Bishop Caldwell statue. He's a huge statue, you know, They worship this guy. So he was a Scottish minister, Christian minister, evangelist. He started the Dravidian movement because he felt that this would be good too for his thing, you know. And the Tamil people, until the early 20th century, did not subscribe to the Dravidian movement. They did not. The Dravidian movement was only a very recent one. If you look at the Tamil classics, the Tamil old texts, which are very old, they have no sense of we are different from the North Indians, we are Dravidians. There is no sense, there is no hint of us versus Aryan, those Aryans. The word Aryan is not there, Dravidian is not there. They, in their own text, it is not there. So when you start with the Thirukkural, which is one of their texts, and there are few major texts, you will find that the ideas are very Hindu type, you know, nature, deities, similar, unity consciousness, all of that. And you will find there is a total absence. There is not one shlok that they can come out with which says we are Dravidian, they are Aryan, we are whatever. That separation of consciousness, is of identity, is absent in their own earliest classics. So you have to figure out when it came, why it came, and how. So that's the short answer of, you know, this Dravidian movement. Now the Dravidian movement become very strong. And it's a political movement, and now it's a very difficult movement to track because the DMK, the D is Dravidian, the AIDMK, their D is also Dravidian only. So one is more Dravidian than the other. That is the, like the Shiites and Sunnis, who is the more radical Muslim? It's that kind of a thing. It's a pretty bad situation.
Namaste, Rajivji. My name is Smita. One follow-up question on the Buddhist thing. Was there a demographic angle too? Because monks are celibate, they don't have children. And was that also a problem? And is there a lesson for us Hindus to learn from that? And
I think that's a factor. That's a factor because, you know, if the people who are the more successful, higher elite, whatever you want to call them, they're being told, leave the family, remain single, go to this big vihar and live there your whole life, pursue this, that is your calling. Then, you know, then they will have less birth rate, they'll be more vulnerable to attack also. So there are a lot of factors like that. You know, the word vihar, the Buddhists used for all their ashram, what we call ashram, you know, universities. And the modern word Bihar comes from Bihar. So I told my Bihari friends that you should be proud that your ancestors were like the Ivy Leagues of the world. Your name is like Ivy League, that's your name. Because they're the Bihar was like the Ivy Leagues, they would attract the cream of students from China and Cambodia and Mongolia and Vietnam and all the Asian kings. Chinese people would send, for many, many dynasties, they would send their cream to in there to learn and bring the knowledge back.
My other question is, so here around the caste conversation, we try to keep the context here whenever we are arguing with someone or when we are talking about our own experiences here. But there will be some dharmacharya in India who's in a very important, very revered, pitha or something, and then they make comments that are not really, reflective of our thinking here. So that is something that is thrown back at us. How do we?
I think first you should say that, you know, it's like the laws that Islam has in Saudi Arabia regarding women, what they have to, how they have to be, or in Iran, are not the basis for persecuting them in this country. Because if a Muslim here had four wives, that would be against the American law. But you cannot persecute a Muslim on the basis that in his brother or his father in Saudi Arabia has got four wives. I mean, how they're behaving there, not his liability. He can say, I don't care damn about it. You go after him if you want to. I'm okay. So you have to be American Hindus, very clearly. You have to say, we live here. We pay our taxes. We're very good citizens. We're contributing in all kind of ways. And we are, this is a pluralistic society. We have all the rights and we are enjoying those rights. And you have to, if you have a problem with us in this country, let's discuss it. If you have a problem with them in that country, you go talk to the Indian government and talk to the ministry, and that's something for you to worry about. None of my business. I think that's a good starting point.
I think the point that you mentioned, Rajit, is really important, because what ends up happening is, in the fight that we saw in California, one of the challenges with Indian people, because most of us are born and raised in India, is we straight away put on the Indian hat and forget the American hat. And we don't talk about being American Hindus. We start defending or saying, oh, this was in India, but it's not meant this way. Or not. It goes into a whole argument. Yeah. Then the other side picks that up and defeats you on that.
Yeah.
You know, as they say in politics, or when you start to explain, you're losing.
Yeah.
So that's the problem we face. I'm really happy you mentioned about American Hindus, because we have things over here. We don't need to worry about that.
Yeah, I think our people are very intelligent. And the problem of being too intelligent is that you take an issue and you over-abstract it and over-generalize it. So when you criticize me for something, I should take the defense required, whatever I require to hit back, very sharp. If I over-generalize it and start trying to defend everybody and so on, you know, billions of people all over, then I have put a burden on my shoulders. I don't need to. We don't need to. In the US context, there is no reason for you to accept the responsibility of defending India or Modi or government. That's your private life. That's your private life. But you're living here and you want to be as much. See, you tell the fellow that you are a Christian. I don't expect you to defend what the church has done in Nigeria. They got slaves there, or they've been caught with pedophiles somewhere. You know, whatever the hell they're doing in different countries. I'm not expecting you to be responsible for that. If you are misbehaving in this country, there's law against you. Okay, but whatever is happening to some Christian somewhere is not your problem. So same way for us, you should not take on responsibilities that are not ours.
Namaste, my name is Anish. So last year in school, they were teaching about the system. So I told them that we never really had any Varna and Jati system. So then he said that I was correct, and the caste system was imposed by us thousands of years later by Westerners. But I know in coming years, they're going to go back to teaching that Hinduism revolves around a caste system, because that's how it is in textbooks. So how do we get the right information to be taught in schools in coming years?
So you should take a few copies of my book. You should take a few copies of my book, give them to your history teachers and cultural studies teachers, and put one in the library. And say, look, here is a lot of evidence, and if you want to talk to the author, call him and you can have a debate with him.
Rajivji, namaste. My name is Kailas. I have a two-part question. Question one, you mentioned an actionable point for all of us to write a 5-pager, 20-pager on the topics in your book. That's a great idea. I would like to know if Kona or any other platform can provide a platform for this, so that this can be one, somebody who's starting new can get a wider audience, irrespective of the quality of work. And that can throw up real quality work in time to come. So I don't know if that's possible at all.
And you know, you can always write as large as you want book review and put it on Amazon, and the author would love it. I mean, if you go to our book, some of my books, we got over 500 reviews. You can every one of you could go to Amazon, Varna Jati Caste book, and write a review. You express yourself, and it goes to the world.
That's a great idea. The second part of the question is, you mentioned Bill Ackman and activism against what has happened in Harvard and four other Ivy League colleges. You have taken on the likes of Anand Mahindra. You have actually named them out.
I've not only named him, I have a whole chapter on him. I have a chapter, another chapter on Mittal, and I have a chapter on Piramal. And we have written about Bajaj. We have written about Tatas. We have written about all these kind of people. And I have only started because if I were to tell you what all is happening with in the name of these Ambanis, you know, probably the worst and most vicious Hindu phobic is a scholar, Professor Hanson, in Stanford. Do you know what his job title is? He's called the Reliance Dhirubhai Ambani Professor. They named their company, they named their father, and they're given millions of dollars and hired this guy. If you were to look at his books, it is the most anti-India, anti-Hindu guy around. And our richest man funding him. So there is a lot of nonsense. And you know, I know it's not goody-goody, but I'm not goody-goody. I mean, I'm getting old. I have to tell people what, even when I was not old, I was telling people like that. But now I have nothing to fear. What's there to fear about? I'm not like asking for any reward, this, that, anything great. I don't want expect anything. And so, you know, they can't hire me, they can't fire me. So I have to speak out.
So how can we as Americans who don't buy Jio phones or Mahindra Jeeps kind of influence these people to not to fund Harvard or Stanford or such chairs?
I think you can just shame them, and that is working. I think these people are on the back foot. You know, some of these people, firstly, none of them have the audacity and courage like Bill Ackman, who's a Jewish guy, to say, hey, I'm going to stop giving them money and I'm going to protest against them and whatnot. None of them have that much confidence. Okay, they're still into this, inferiority complex. They want to suck up to the white man and be like one of him and get a pat on the back. They don't have that courage and confidence, no matter how much money they have. But the point is that when you name them, and we go on and on, and so many people are now, I'm not the only guy now. Now every time something happens, they tag Anand Mahindra and say, what are you doing about it? So they are affected. So they will not withdraw. I mean, it would be great if he were to write a letter to the Mahindra Center and say, I'm withdrawing my money unless you do 1, 2, 3, 4, these things. And you should stop doing A, B, C, and you should start doing 1, 2, 3. Otherwise, I'm stopping my money. That would be very good. He's not going to do that. But next time he has to give money, he may think twice. And this guy recently, what was his name? The guy who, Paytm Sharma. I don't know if you followed the thread on Twitter. He went and somewhere in Gujarat, and he was given this big thing that, oh, he's one of these Make in India patriotic fellows. And then we put out a post saying that in our book, Snakes in the Ganga, he is a guy who's been funded Harvard, and here he's given money, this, that, that. So very quickly he wrote back saying, no, sir, must be a mistake. I'm not giving money. And so then we wrote another one. And we showed a press release where he's standing there and saying, I'm giving all this money to Harvard. So more people then came back and said, oh, you are a liar also. You're not only giving money, but you're also telling lies. Why don't you tell the truth? So we exchanged the private DMs. He called me within 5 minutes. He said, oh, no, sir, I'm not doing this, that. He called me, we had a long chat. Very nice guy. Okay. And he said, I have signed an agreement. I'm telling you that I have signed an agreement. But I'm also telling you I will not pay them anything. I said, well, then I'm very happy. So I put out a tweet saying that I'm very congratulations to this guy. He's not going to give them any money. He signed an agreement, but he's not going to give them any money. I think it works. This kind of publicly going after these guys works, because you know some of them, they have this thing about they want to be in the good books of everybody, and now they have to make a choice. Do they want to be in the good books, the Harvard people, or the Aam Aadmi in India, the common person? And if the common person knows that there is a contradiction, there's a double life, then we force them to make a choice.
Any other question? Okay, one more.
Namaste, Rajivji. So adding on to the question by the school kid, so how do we change the narrative in the textbooks? So before, you know, it's getting, we give the copy of your book to the teacher, but the book is already printed. So we need to do some action and correcting that.
So, you know, one of the, for our 30th anniversary, we are putting out many books.
on impact we've had. What are the big projects we funded? What impact we've had? One of them is on interventions in the school system in the United States. We've had about 15 projects. I was the commissioner of Asian Studies in New Jersey under Governor McGreevy. We funded somebody regarding the Virginia textbooks, Texas textbooks, an organization called CAPIM in California for the California textbooks. So we've been doing this for like 20 years, 25 years. So this is a very long-term process. The point is, we never got a critical mass of funding and people support. We always were a few people trying to make noise and criticize and get back. But we never got, like the Muslims, they organize, they'll have all the mosques are going to talk about it, everybody going to call this publisher Islamophobic, and they'll all write petitions to their senators and congressmen. I mean, they have the ability to raise hell. We don't have that. This is a problem. The problem is that we, gurus not going to stick their neck out. Go to all the Hindu mandirs and ashrams in New Jersey and say, sign this petition. I would like Nikunj to draft a petition on something, and you guys volunteer. Every one of you say, okay, I'll go to 5 temples. And my job is to get these 5 temples, top person in charge of the temple, president or whoever, to sign the petition. I challenge you to do that. It's not so easy. They'll give you a room, they'll give you some samosas also, they'll give you nice, keep. You know, they'll be very nice, which is good. At least they're doing that now. They were not doing that earlier. But they're not going to stick their neck out. This is the problem. Yeah, unless you see the Indian industrialists are giving money to the wrong people, and we are calling it out. I've also been calling out the gurus and our own, because they also have to be told. You're teaching us all these things to our kids, nice things, good things, Gita and all. But in the Gita, the basic lesson is you have to go and fight in the Kurukshetra. So this is the Kurukshetra we're talking about. This is the Kurukshetra. And these people we are fighting are the Duryodhans. They are the today's Duryodhans. So our gurus have to teach how to fight that also. They're not doing it.
I really want to thank Rajiv Ji for this wonderful, engaging session. This is just the beginning, and we're really planning to support, of course, Rajiv Ji on the 30th anniversary, so August 10th. I urge everybody to be there. Last year, we had over 1,000 people. This year, we maybe have more. Who knows? Let's see.
2,000.
Yeah, so like we got want to get to, yeah, exactly. So let's do that.